Here we are. Wait, before we get into the serious stuff, I have to call you out for something.
Okay.
Looked like the mustache was making a comeback again, and now there's no mustache again. What's going on? You're killing me with the back and forth flirting with a mustache. I want you to commit to the mustache, but I understand.
Well,
all right.
It's, as you know, when it comes to facial hair, it's really not up to you.
Right. There's two opinions that matter, 100%. And one matters more, for sure. Yes.
I am. I've been dealt with a curse of like really, really thick hair, which I'm grateful for. My dad just turned 80. His hair looks like he just stepped out of a 60s greaser movie.
300 years from now, your skull will have a full head of hair. Right.
Totally.
Yeah.
But the thickness of my hair also means that when it comes out of my face, it's basically like tiny little razor blades
100%.
That just want to inflict pain on everybody. So the people that want affection from me, or want to give me affection, they are not into it.
Yeah, fair enough, fair enough.
The part of me that wants to honor my RAF grandfather with that like perfect, the air fighter, the bomber mustache. Yeah, that guy's, he's going to have to go and live in a cave if he wants to get that.
right. Well, that makes sense though, right? Like the guys that grew those badass mustaches were like in that Apple series, they were in an airplane with a bunch of other dudes. It didn't matter that they were growing, you know, like essentially like wire scrubbers on under their nose.
Yeah. Like, yeah. And it was like during an age where, you know, even if your partner had said, listen, I don't like that, you'd just be like, get back in the kitchen.
Exactly.
Do something obnoxious like that. Yeah.
That was an era where there was one opinion.
We're done with that.
Well then, so like, it's good to know. I'll set my expectations accordingly. I was hoping I would get the nerve to meet you in the middle, because I've been like shaving my beard closer and closer, because I want similarly to like just swing for it and go for like the Magnum PI, just like a mustache. Like my dad, like everybody's dad who was an American dad in the 70s, they all just had a big stupid mustache. Like
this is what I want,
connectors.
This is the last thing on my bucket list.
It's a thing. It's like, you know, everybody looked like an undercover cop in the 70s. Yeah, that's the kind of aesthetic. And I keep like shaving it further and further. And I'm getting the opposite, which is Gwen is saying to me, like, be careful. Like, just be careful. You've gone down to no beard before and you hated it. Like, just, reminder, you've done this before. And, this beard is doing a lot of heavy lifting in obfuscating jawline a little bit. Like, I think if I don't have any of it, then like what is a hint of a little chin here becomes like, I look like, like sausage packed into two little casing. So that's mustache talk to kick us off this week.
Yeah. Well, it's not November, even though you assumed it might be.
Exactly. No.
It's still springtime.
It started and then it went away and it's coming back. I'm like, oh, we're going to give this a second shot.
Yeah. No,
then,
I was hopeful, but like many things in life, compromise is ultimately where you end up.
Yeah. Absolutely. Listen, like there'll be a time. There'll be a time and a place where like there's a window where you can go all in on the mustache at some point. Now is not the time. It's fine.
No.
Right.
No.
But speaking of being timely, you and I were talking a little bit offline about this. I bumped into a former colleague of mine, a former client of mine, who's now a neighbor, which is delightful, just to kind of like have somebody from my work life move into the area. And he's since moved out of the web world and now works in staffing and consulting and recruiting. And he's more in that kind of, I love this term because it's so terrible, human capital management. I love when people call it human capital management. But he's more in that arena. But he was saying that he's sending clips from our podcast to his sales team. Like, even though they're not like agency or, you know, creative teams or internal creative teams or whatever, like he's finding some value in some of the stuff we've been talking about, some of the stuff we've been clipping out being applicable to his, you know, more traditional sales infrastructure. Like this is like, this is like phone sales, meeting sales. Like this is very much like old school playbook, sales playbook, and then trying to draw from our kind of client services, consultative partner kind of selling approach, and trying to find like little ribbons he can pull on that feed into his more mainstream sales team and their goals. And then when I mentioned that to you, it sounds like this is a timely conversation because you've had a similar experience.
Yeah, so there's probably two parts to this that we should consider. One is that there's a, an admission that you and I should like just come clean, and that is, even though we started these conversations, the you can't lose conversations with client services and agencies in mind, we drifted all over the place. And I have sales experience pre-agency and also post-agency in the SaaS world, and mostly enterprise, like big complicated sales. And so sometimes when you're giving advice, it's not just for client services. It's like, this is sales advice, period. Like, it
Agreed.
is in the Daniel Pink description or definition of sales, it's moving people from one place to another. They are of one mindset, or they are of one opinion, and then they move towards another opinion, and you are helpful in that. And that could be, you could be a lawyer, you could be a lobbyist, you could be a nonprofit person. That is, sales is sales. Okay, so that's the first thing. And then I think that the second thing is that there has been a general macro shift in both sales and marketing, right? Sales specifically in the sense that it was just drinking from a fire hose of digitally generated growth leads from marketing. And that kind of ended the whole, let's just staff up with BDRs and SDRs and we'll get enough in the funnel to make it work. That hasn't really played out long term. It kind of worked for a while. It didn't last for too long. And on the marketer's end, they're somewhat incapable of generating the quantity of leads that they used to in the same way, in the kind of the digital growth marketing strategy. So they're also starting to ask questions. I just had a conversation with a CMO this morning, and she was saying there is a group of the SaaS marketplace which is still holding desperately onto that thread of like, if we just spend one more dollar on the AdWords, we'll get a lead. And the reality is, it just doesn't get the same value out of it. Now, that's hard to believe when you see the kind of revenue generated from people like Meta and Google for advertising. But that's really, those are the holdouts saying, look, if we just keep spending, something good will happen. The reality is, it's harder. It really is more difficult to do that. So those are the two things. One is like, we have general expressions and ideas and thoughts about what sales should look like. And the market is also changing. So if somebody's in recruiting and they're listening to this, they might go, well, actually, that's kind of useful because what works in one sector will probably find its way eventually into other sectors, whether that's long term or short term. So yeah, and I think the big thing that we like to talk about is we have done reps. Like, we have been to the gym of sales. And when you're in the agency world, you do reps. You do so many more reps than people can even imagine. So in I calculated that, and depends on how you define a project, but during the Fresh Till Soil 15 years of Fresh Till Soil, we did anything from 500 to 700 projects, depending on how you slice that. Now, it sounds like a huge number, and then you go, oh, actually, so it's 15 years. How many projects are you doing per year? Kind of, I'm like, oh, okay, 20-ish, 20, 30 projects a year starts to make a lot of sense. You start to kind of do the math. But the thing that you understand from that number is that previous to getting that project, you had to then go on a lot of dates. So there was probably thousands. I don't know what the exact number was. We could probably work it out. But let's say for every 10 meetings you have, you close one of them.
Like, what was your
Give or take.
win rate kind of,
Yeah,
gut?
and it varied.
20%, right? So then,
In the early days, it was crap, and then it got really good, and then it kind of
80%.
plateaued out a bit, and then we kind of had to deal with the fact that,
That's very credible.
even though we were early on and we benefited from that, eventually we weren't. We were, the market was saturated with people just like us, and so competition got really high. So I think when we come at this with our perspective, we're not just saying, well, you should do it like us. What we're saying is we went out there and we did an inordinately large amount of reps. Like, we met thousands of times with lots of different kinds of companies. We can talk about the specifics of that in a minute, but lots of different kinds of companies. And because we did so many reps, we got to try different things. We said, well, what if this works? We should try that. And then, just like you would be if you were in the lab, you're like, well, we get the opportunity to run not just one A/B test, but 1,000 A/B tests. And then over time, also, we see the market changing. So 15 years is a very long time in
right.
digital space.
Yes.
You get to see, oh, that worked well then. It's not right. working really well now. Let's pivot. Yep. So we probably did a handful of pivots during that period.
Right.
And so when we're coming to this conversation, we disclaim this by saying, look, don't do what we do. Go and figure out your own methodology. But listen to what we did, because we got to do a lot of the experimentation.
Yep.
That you may not have had the opportunity to do yet. And just like I say to my son, in fact, I said it to him this morning because he was asking me a question about mistakes. I was like, look, you learn from your own mistakes, but the best thing to do is learn from other people's mistakes. Like, don't go and make the same mistake that your buddy did.
Yeah.
Like, learn from that. Like,
yes,
you right. get you get a pass. You get like a basic an acceleration.
You get to start three spaces further on the Candyland board than
exactly.
you know, where you might start. And I think, so plus one to what you said about just having those reps, totally, you know, same kind of math. And to your past experience, my past experience, we both have a foothold in lots of other flavors of sales beyond even that bank of client services and agency business development experience. You know, everything from, like, I was a waiter. I worked in customer service on the phones. I've been a recruiter. I've worked in marketing for, like, a small book distributor. Like, just, you know, I worked in a Barnes and Noble. I've worked at SAP prep companies. Like, I've worked in a lot of versions of selling environments and, you know, frankly, learned a lot of what not to do's more than I learned what to do's in a lot of those environments. But I agree with you that, like, there's a sum total that is valuable. And just to kind of reiterate on something else you said that I think is critically important, I'll call out who I hope will be a future guest on the podcast. If you want to look closely at how the underpinnings of digital selling and marketing are changing under our feet, follow Will Reynolds on LinkedIn.
Mm-hmm.
Will Reynolds is talking about figuring out and working his way through the rapidly changing landscape of all of this in real time in LinkedIn posts. Like, it is he's being very generous and transparent with what he's thinking about and what he's dealing with and how he thinks. Like, he just posted yesterday, a job posting for someone to join Seer, his SEO and kind of services firm, in a marketing role, which is no big deal. Like, he put up a job posting hiring somebody to join the marketing team, right? But if you read it, he very quickly gets into, like, this is not a role for someone that's looking to press spam on a button to do more things. Like, this is, I want someone that wants to write things people connect with. I want someone that wants to, is like a content junkie that wants to create, you know, very clearly in the way he describes what he wants the nature of this role to be. He is very clearly describing where he thinks energy needs to be invested, as things like organic SEO and Google AdWords and all of this is facing a lot of AI uncertainty. And frankly, he writes very directly about that uncertainty too. Like, there was another post he had yesterday that was about, you know, just basically acknowledging that it's always a mistake to invest all of your sales strategy in one platform, in one kind of economic practice. That's dangerous for any technology at any time. Nothing's foolproof, right? And similarly, if you had historically poured all of your investment and effort into something like Google AdWords, feeling like, well, this is like, you know, this is like investing in oxygen. Like, this is a commodity that will always be here and never lose value. And then AI is definitely kicking this in the shins to a degree that's yet to be fully figured out. And, you know, Will's recommendations on LinkedIn say things like, you know, it's not that this shouldn't be a weapon in your arsenal at all, but hopefully while you've been investing for the past 10 years in Google AdWords or search or SEO, you have similarly been, like, very deliberately building an authentic audience out of content you've been creating. You've been building relationships. You've been doing all the other things that are kind of like the typical suite of things you do in marketing and sales. Like, ideally, you've been doing those things while you've been checking this kind of programmatic box, because you're going to need maybe a little bit more of column B right now than you can count on column A while there is this uncertainty. So again, to your point, there becomes enterprise playbooks for how selling is done at scale, with typically a lot of programmatic CRM, bells and whistles, HubSpot this, whatever, there becomes a very clear formula that people are attracted to. And then they 2 times it, 5 times it, 100 times it, 1,000 times it. And that has been a playbook for people in the past. But what a lot of people are experiencing now is a critical disruption to the foundational underpinning that a lot of that strategy has been built upon, and pulling their hair out, trying to figure out, well, how do I sell then? Like, how do I sell if I can't, you know, point A to point B, step 3, step 4, step 5 in this kind of programmatic sales methodology? How the hell do I even start if I don't have, like, what is the playbook? What is the tree? What is the steps? What are the routes I take? Without that kind of very direct direction, there's a lot of people who are in an existential crisis about, well, then. And it's funny because, you know, how did you sell before you did all this? This is, some people have been selling since there have been people. So, like, there's lots of other avenues. It's just, you know, once something becomes the lifeblood of how this part of the organization behaves, you become very unaccustomed to being without the lifeblood that fuels everything. So it's a huge crisis right now.
Human beings adapt. And I think that's the critical part that either the leadership or the decision makers aren't taking into account as mm-hmm. they embark on these strategies. When we started delivering, my first company, we were serving banner ads. Remember banner ads?
Oh, love me some banner ads. I used to, one of my biggest clients when I was a recruiter was Point Roll in Philadelphia, and they were all about them banner ads.
Yeah. So this is going back to the late 1990s. So, you know, ancient times, dinosaurs were just sick.
That's right. The dinosaurs had a progressive cough.
and people clicked on banners. At rates that were so amazing that we were able to charge $20 CPM. $20 CPMs. We were rolling in the cash. Yeah. We didn't know what to do with ourselves.
Yeah, yeah.
And several years later, they stopped clicking.
Right.
And this is the really important part of any marketing or sales strategy, is that your customer, your, however you describe them, the person that uses your product to gain value, will adapt. Human beings are this incredible adaptation machine. This is the thing that has kept them alive, because we don't have horns and spikes and armor. We are basically the chicken nuggets of the animal world.
This is true. That's very good.
Boneless chicken nuggets. We're like, that's delicious. That didn't even put up a fight.
Just pop right in. It's just so easy to eat. It's delightful. Yeah, 100%.
We don't put up much of a fight. We're very soft. And yet we are doing what we're doing. Yeah. And the reason is because we're very, very adaptable.
Yeah.
And the mistake people make is that the evolutionary timeline on which adaptation happens was given to us by our biology teachers as being something that happens over millions or hundreds of thousands of years. And yet that's not true at all.
Right.
Within your lifetime, you will adapt 100 times, 1,000 times to all the different things that happen to you.
Yeah.
And our plasticity is being now proven by neurologists and biologists every single day as being way more efficient at adaptation than we even thought. Your kids grow up and then they stop growing, and then you basically stuck with what you have. But it turns out none of that's true.
Right.
And so in the context of what we're talking about, when your customer is adapting to the messaging, the medium, the channel that you have created, you must also assume that you're going to have that for a limited period of time. It's temporary. And then you're going to have to start inventing new ways to do things. And time again, this is where leadership gets caught out, because they embark on a strategy, they assemble a team with those specific skills to deliver on that strategy.
Right.
And then when it starts to fail, instead of changing the strategy, changing the channels, changing the methodology, changing the creative message, pivoting to new conversations, they panic and they do exactly what you described, which is they double down on the things that are not working.
You're right.
So to connect this back to our conversation about sales specifically is that if your sales strategy delivered for a long period of time, there's a good chance that if you are experiencing that peak of it, that you're about to start failing and you need to start thinking about how to do this differently. Now, what that also means is you may have to consider the fact that you're going to have to change the assembly of that team. To use Jim Collins' terms, the bus will need to pull over and you'll need to exchange certain seats on that bus for new people. And unless you've got a really creative, adaptable leader, you can do that, which is rare. There are a handful. But I'll give you a very anecdotal example. I worked with somebody recently who is quite young and had grown up during this digital growth marketing, I mean, epoch, it spells like it, but it's not that long. It's only been like 10 years of it. And she was unaware of some of the more hand-to-hand combat techniques that we had used before there was such a thing as digital marketing. She had never run an event before. She had never done the one-on-one type of content creation where you're reaching out to somebody, asking them for their opinion, inviting them into an environment like a podcast or an interview where you can then capture that content and then repurpose that content, what I call the Oprah strategy, which is invite somebody to your stage, give them attention, take that content, which in many cases, it's really just an interview. You're just giving a platform for somebody to share their ideas. Yeah. Then capture that, transcribe it, turn it into 20, 40, 50 different kinds of things that you can. And it just so happened that this person hadn't had experience with that because they were in that generation that hadn't experienced it before.
Right.
Hadn't had to, right? Their skill set was in HubSpot, in AdWords, in the kind of analytics-driven growth marketing that we've become used to. And so it wasn't so much that they couldn't do it. They just hadn't seen it before.
Exactly.
Right. And so this is the same with salespeople.
Does it mean you can't learn how to ride a horse?
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, I'm having this conversation with one of my clients right now. They have had some success with a certain kind of sales strategy, but there's definitely a plateau. Like we just haven't seen the kind of bumps that we would expect to see. And so we need to start zigging where we used to zag. And that's a hard conversation because sometimes it means the neural loops that we've set up, ours and also our teams and the communications and the strategies that we put into place, we have to say, well we're going to have to change those. And it's a humility that doesn't exist anymore. We spoke about humility last week.
Yes.
There's this, you know, that's why I like people like Will Reynolds is because he embodies that humility. He says, look, I don't know, or I'm not sure, or this is probably only going to work for a little bit longer and then I'm going to have to do something else.
Right.
And the paradox, of course, is that somebody like Will or Nancy or somebody like that can be very, very, very passionate about the thing that they're doing at the time. And what you might hear is, oh, that's their thing. Their rally cry. And that's the sword that they're going to die on.
100%.
But if you know them long enough, they also go, that sword is no longer serving me.
Yes.
And they toss it aside and they pick up something else.
Yep.
And they're willing to do that. And they're willing to say, I was wrong or I became wrong or I changed my mind.
Yep.
And I think that's really what we're suggesting here when it comes to sales strategy is that when you do the number of reps that you and I have done and you go out and you have the number of conversations that you are expected to have when you run an agency or client services company, you have to adapt. You don't have a choice.
Yeah.
And for those of you who are out there thinking, gee, how do I get good at sales? There really isn't a shortcut in terms of learning the nuances of human interaction.
Right.
But what you can do is you can double down on those reps and you can get there faster. And what's really, really helpful is have fun with it. Like there is a lot of research to show that playfulness actually creates a higher degree of memory translation. So like from experiential to semantic memory, that thing is amplified significantly by the amount of fun you have.
Right.
To join a company or have a team where you can have fun with it. You can like, look, let's just go try a bunch of weird stuff.
Experiment.
Yeah. Like,
Yeah.
hey, we're gonna run an event. We've never done it before. Let's go and do that anyway.
Exactly.
Oh, it's gonna be less than perfect. That's okay. Let's do it anyway. Let's just have
Right.
fun with it.
Yeah.
And let's be honest. Like, let's post on LinkedIn and say, we really don't know exactly what the answers are here.
Yeah.
But we're gonna try. We're gonna say Yeah. stuff. We're gonna like share our ideas, and in that way build that sense of, look, we're all human beings. We're all just trying. We're just trying to like get through the day, and we're not perfect, and you're not perfect, and just ready to start a conversation.
Yep. I think that's part of what plagues people, to your point, in like a large organization, is changing is almost like admitting failure, unfortunately. Like that is,
yes.
is sometimes what changing is mistaken for, is this thing is no longer working. I am suggesting we take a risk, which large organizations are averse to begin with. But I think we should take this thing that is not working optimally anymore. And before it completely runs out of gas, we should burn it down and start doing one of these other things. And that might mean, to your point, reorganizing things or reorganizing people or reorganizing process. But a lot of people feel like their personal equity within the organization is directly related to success on a graph that shows that these things make the line move up and to the right every time. And change is a synonym for failure, which it's not. Like, I think that is, that's unfortunately the case in a lot of organizations. And to your point, I think that one of the reasons why, and this is a generalization, one of the reasons why some of these strategies exhaust over time is because people are good at adapting, audiences are good at adapting, marketplaces are good at adapting. We build resistance to marketing over time. Mm-hmm. Like, we start to perceive that banner ad is marketing. And where before it felt playful to have the Spider-Man guy start crawling around on the web banner, and I'm going to click on that because that's a fun, shiny thing to click on. Now I recognize that as marketing, and it makes me cranky because I have evolved. So part of it is just acknowledging that people are resistant to being marketed at. They're not resistant to authenticity. They're not resistant to value. They're not resistant to thoughtfulness. They are resistant to feeling like prey, to feeling like they're being marketed at. So as soon as
but that doesn't make us infallible, right? We're still falling for the next thing, right? I mean, I look at my middle son, who's 21 now, and you know, he'll say things. I'll say, well, where do you get that idea from, or that opinion about that brand from? And he's like, well, I saw this thing on Instagram, or I saw this thing on TikTok or whatever. And I'm like, has it crossed your mind that that's a manufactured thing, right? that influencer's voice that you trust has to also pay rent?
Right.
That influencer has to feed themselves.
Yes, yes, yes.
So somebody's paying them for that opinion or to, and at first there's like this, that normal kind of, oh, well, but this, I trust this influencer. This, you know, this person is a journalist or something like that. And you're like, yes, but they have a platform that's paid for. So, so if that's the case and you're receiving that for free, then you're the product. So what is it that they want you to believe?
Yeah.
And very often it then, you know, and it has led to the fact that at one point he uninstalled a lot of these social media because it was just like, shit, I am the product.
Right.
And so, you know, we are humans. We adapt.
Right.
As humans who are trying to get people to move from one place to another, we also need to be adaptive. And so the many reps as you can do and trying lots of experiments, I mean, that's one of the reasons why we wrote Design Sprints, is because it's just an experimental paradigm. It's just like a way of thinking. You're like, have a thesis.
Yeah.
Go out and see how you can test that thesis with a bunch of ideas.
100%.
Look at the data. Recalibrate. You're like, oh, that really worked. We should try that again.
Yep.
Or that sucked. Let's not do that again.
Yeah.
100%. And that fuck around and find out mentality is a very humble place to be, because you essentially come to work every week and say, let's try some stuff.
100%. I love describing it as play or experimenting too. I think that, like, to be clear, just because things are experiments, just because you are playing around with the methodology, it doesn't mean that every experiment needs to be playful. Like, it doesn't mean that every experiment needs to be install a ball pit or, like, you know, face painting or something. Like, play is like...
No, that's not the, that's not the point.
Play means like playing around with things, manipulating things, trying things, like that, right. Experimenting with things. And to
it
your
doesn't point, mean it can't be fun. It just means that it shouldn't be taken so seriously. Like, every decision doesn't have to be backed up with a 6 months research project.
Right. If you, 100%.
20 qualitative calls will give you 80% confidence.
Yes.
Give you as much information as you need. 100%. You don't have to run a, you know, a longitudinal study that's going to take months or years.
Yeah, like, you don't have to show me.
And I think that's where I'm at with that. Is,
yep.
The playfulness is not so much about substituting serious good work for, you know, kind of frivolous antics.
Yeah.
It's more about like, well, if we don't take this too seriously, we can actually have the opportunity to try some new things. To have, like, there's novelty in that. Like,
yes.
I think of, when I think of playfulness, I think of novelty, because that's what I mean, think about it. You're in a relationship with your wife for, you know, a gazillion years. Like, novelty is actually one of the things that disappears over time. Mm-hmm. And so you're constantly trying to think of, like, how can we make this worthwhile? Like, what is the other stuff that we're doing? And that's your job as a marketer, as a salesperson, is what are we doing here? What are we trying to do here that's novel, that's interesting, that's going to create a new neural circuit?
Yeah.
So I think we've kind of maybe beaten the horse on this one. So, like, reps is really important. But the other part of doing sales in an agency environment, and this is true of startups as well. So when you're a small team, either pre-funding or really close to just like getting that first round of funding, one of the things that you find yourself doing is punching above your weight. Maybe you've only got 5 people or 10 people or 20 people. Mm-hmm. We spoke about this on one of the other episodes about how you take a company like the original Instagram, the original Pinterest, the original WhatsApp, the original Duolingos. All of those companies had like 20 people, 15 people.
Right. Yeah.
So why were they so successful? It's because they were, by design, having to punch above their weight. They were having to be creative. They were rubbing brass panties together, thinking like, how do we make this work harder? And I think when you're in an agency environment, especially like we were for as long as we were, we got really good at thinking about how to make a dollar go really, really, really far.
Do more with less. Yep.
100%. Yeah. Yep. And instead of saying, well, let's just go and spend $100,000 a month on AdWords, we didn't have that luxury.
Right.
That wasn't even on the table. We were like,
right, exactly. Yep.
So we have our marketing budget this month is $1,000.
Yep.
Our sales budget is $1,000. Like, we didn't have the money.
Yep.
So it forced us to become guerrilla marketers, guerrilla salespeople. We started getting really smart about what we were going to do. And we would say, well, what does the hand-to-hand version of this look like? You know, if we can't go out and market to 500 million people tomorrow, what is the equivalent of that? You're coming up with creative ideas, creative copy.
Yep.
You're breaking through the noise. So instead of just saying, well, look, we're the next thing.
Yeah.
You know, we're just like one feature different from everybody else. We would have to come up with a way to pick a fight with the 800-pound gorilla that was already in the marketplace, right? So, you know, we would pick fights with people like IDEO and Frog and Pentagram. Like, I remember this woman wrote an article about how she was a senior partner at Pentagram, and she was like, oh, design thinking is such crap and everything. And obviously, design thinking was a core part of the UX, UI, digital product revolution. And so I wrote an article saying, design thinking is crap. Well, I think she used the word bullshit or something like that. But, you know, you pick a fight with Pentagram. You pick a fight with you know, so that you can then level that into the social media conversation or level that into the kind of the forum where your ideal customer is looking at that and going, I kind of like that these guys are little upstarts and they've got an opinion and they've got a point of view. And, and so you start to, when it comes to sales as well, you start to get very, very good at defining what's worth it and what's not. So instead of your pipeline being filled with 100 deals, You're like, look, I don't have time for 100 deals.
Exactly.
I'm not going to be able to give attention to 100 deals. You get really good at asking questions like, hey, Joe.
Yeah.
You filled out the form. It looks like you've got this interesting project. What's your budget?
Yeah.
What's your timeline? Like you get to the core and they're like, well, you know, you tell us. And you're like, we don't work like that. Sorry, next, move on. Like you get to the point where you don't suffer fools because you don't have the time to.
Right, you exactly.
You can't do the 12-month sales cycle.
Yep.
And so I think punching above your weight is a mindset that you gain from working in a small agency that you can take to any other company. Like when I went from Fertile Soil to InVision, a lot of what I was doing was, look, I've got a small team with a small budget.
Right.
There's a lot of purse string holders that are above me and that in the kind of the hierarchy. I can't just say, well, I'm going to spend crazy money.
Right.
In fact, when I joined, a lot of it was about like the opposite. It was like, well, we got to spend less money.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, well, how are we going to make a big bash? Well, could we do this little crazy idea? Like we made movies.
Mm-hmm.
People are like, wow, movie sounds expensive. You're like, actually, a documentary is really cheap. You can make a documentary for a couple of $100,000 and you can get that into tens of thousands of households.
Yep.
Especially like in our space, we were going after a particular kind of audience. But that's the kind of crazy stuff you come up with. You're like, let's do something wild.
Right.
That nobody else is doing.
Yep.
And then, you know, we'll rent out a park in New York City and we'll do like a live screening.
Mm.
You know, and then we'll make content about that. Like that'll become a social media story.
Yep.
So you just become really good at doing more with less. And so now in an era where everybody's consolidating budgets and consolidating tools and stacks, and that's kind of the era we're in, like let's do more with less.
Yep.
That's my comfort zone. I'm like, that's where I lived for most of my life. Totally. Like, you can't scare me. Like,
right.
No, I'm not going to get my knickers in a twist because my boss said to me, oh, we've got to cut budgets. I'm like, great.
Let's cut budgets then. That's right. You've merely adopted the strategy of do more with less. I grew up, I was born in do more with less. Like, welcome to the darkness. 100%. And I think, not to be pedantic about this, and if I'm connecting dots overly, forgive me, but for our listener, one way to look at what you're talking about is you don't have Accenture's budget or KPMG's budget to have a Super Bowl commercial to reach every household in the world and then have audiences self-select in. What you probably want to do is find a place where a higher concentration of the right kinds of audience already occurs and do something there. So rather than a massive kind of generalist approach with a huge budget trying to find some signal in the noise, you don't have that luxury. You probably have to be choosier. You have to make some choices. You have to decide, okay, we're going to occur here in this window of opportunity, in this place, in this conference, wherever, because we feel like there's a higher concentration of possible people we want to connect with. We feel like we can make a bigger impact in a smaller pond. Our limited dollar spend is better spent in what feels like a smaller audience, higher yield bet, whatever that is. Like when you were talking about, you know, experimenting, it completely triggered in my brain, like flashes of all these little things we tried to do, especially when I was at HappyCog, to try to experiment, you know, try things around the margin, see if this would work. You know, I have a crackpot theory or a half-baked hypothesis that seems like it's got some proof here. It seems like there's
Owner Camp was a perfectly good example of that,
where
it was a bit of a harebrained idea, to be honest. Like, why should you bring all of your competitors together in a room and ask them to pay, by the way, thousands of dollars to fly to remote locations? What were you thinking? It didn't make any, like on paper.
Yep.
Nobody would sign off on that. And yet you sent out the invites.
Right.
You probably had a waiting list. You had a whole bunch of people show up.
Yeah.
And it persisted and sustained for many, many years.
And I wasn't even thinking of that, but that's a perfect example because South by Southwest had become so cumbersome and bloated and vast and crazy. What had been South by Southwest and the marketing community just connectivity benefit of a conference like that was no longer available at the scale it was at. Historically, the owner camp owners that were part of the original sequence of those events were a lot of people that were like harvested from what had been South by Southwest, you know, in early 2000s. And when it was the 300 person conference with one track, and you know, you would just see everybody from the industry. Everyone from the industry would relocate to Austin for the same period of time, and you'd bump into everybody, and it was massively valuable. Yeah. And then, to its credit, it became massively valuable, and it became an Uber conference to consume all conferences. And I think the point of tension was, we were at South by Southwest at HappyCog, and we were staying in, we couldn't get a hotel in Austin because we waited too long. So then we were in a hotel that was a taxi cab ride of 10 minutes outside of Austin. This is pre-rideshare, pre-Uber, whatever. And we simply could not get a taxi into the convention center in time to see a HappyCog person's panel, because there was an hour and a half wait to get into a cab to go 7 miles. So it just had like exploded beyond being valuable. It used to be you could go into Ginger Man or a bar, you know, down on whatever that, I can't remember the name of the street anymore, but like you could go to places there, go to Jackalope, you would see, you know, 15 people you knew at a small conference. And frankly, it just grew beyond suitability. And Owner Camp became like, well, what if we just did our own version of this in a different location with the same kind of people and try to like recreate the same vibe? That was a very easy pitch for people that had experienced South By. And like,
yeah, and I think that if you listen to this, the point to take away is very often the best ideas are not ideal on paper,
right?
But your below the neck instinct should tell you that they're a good idea.
Right.
You should ignore the complete rationalization.
Yes.
And think to yourself, how can we do this without spending money and time? You know,
right.
That's, or maybe we'd spend a little bit of time, but like, how can we get this to pay for itself? How can we get this to do?
Yeah.
And that's what I mean about punching above your weight is you,
you
don't say, well, we're going to go and like, I mean, many of my clients are like, I go to Cannes every year. Right. And they'll be like, oh, it's going to cost us $65,000 a day to get one of those yachts in the basin.
Yeah.
And then I would show up to one of my clients' events, and there'd be like 5 people on the yacht. And then there'd be like 1,000 people on the yacht next door. And you're like,
right.
How does this make sense? And they're like, well, everybody's got a yacht now. And they've got the cooler yacht. And they've got
exactly.
No, they got the celebrity DJ or whatever.
Exactly.
And so
it's,
you know, if you reverse that thinking, you're like, well, okay, if we're going to spend $65,000, what would we do if we couldn't get a yacht? If we didn't do anything that's on the menu of things that people do at Cannes.
Right.
And then you start coming up with these other ideas like we did. We're like, well, what if we got a chateau like an hour away in southern France, and we said, hey, listen, if you're coming to Cannes, come 2 days early and we'll do this like amazing set of workshops. And in between that, we'll be doing yoga and we'll do rides and we'll do hikes and we'll have like these amazing like, you know, mission star style picnics on the lawn. And it was like, great. I'd love to be there. Like, I want to be there. And like, you know, there's 30 or 40 other people who are doing the same thing. And it's a really intimate and lovely.
That's
and it's different.
Yeah. And that's it. But that's the point is if you're not listening to your point, like to the below the collar part of you that feels drawn to something that's a little bit of a risk, if it's not a little bit of a risk, it's going to blend in with everything else. I mean, to your example, like if you are so certain it's going to work, there's such a business case, a rigid ironclad business case that this always works or this is the way to do it, then everybody's doing that and welcome to like deciding to operate at the same level as those people.
Well, like, you just mentioned business cases. I think this is where part of the failure comes in, is that, you know, what we've done is set the standard around the MBA business case, right? This is the case study that you do when you go to business school. I was actually talking to a mutual friend of ours who runs an agency, and he's doing his MBA. And he's like, I'm reading all these business cases. And I said, well, let me tell you a story. Like, I know a guy who's been fortunate enough to be part of 3 IPOs. Really rare. Like, and he was also a general partner at General Catalyst. So that's like rarefied air. There's like maybe 1 of 10 or 20 people in the world who can say they've been that lucky. And really, it is luck. I said to him, okay, so tell me, how do you replicate that success? And he says, you can't.
He did it three times. Because what's the solution? Right. Yeah.
There's no answer to the question, because as he says, when we did the first IPO, these were the market conditions. This was the timing. This is where things were. This is where regulation was.
Right.
That doesn't exist anymore. Right, so we could never do that one again.
Right.
And then IPO number two, we did these things.
Right.
Well, yeah, now there's laws that prevent that from happening, or there's changes, or this is like a very competitive space because we were the first, and now there's like a million competitors in that space.
Yeah.
And for every IPO, he was like, look, for every, you know, MBA level case study that was created about those things, and they just happened to be companies that happened to make their way into the Harvards and the Sloans and all that. He's like, I'll give you the counter for that, which is like, you could never ever do that again.
Oh, yeah.
And so studying the cases isn't really the way to do it. What you've got to do is understand principles of human behavior.
Yeah.
And so once you understand principles of human behavior with this caveat that humans are always changing, they're always adapting, they're always getting smarter too. Like, I mean, AI is a really good example of this. Like when the first AI came out, you're like, wow, that's, remember the Will Smith spaghetti arms guy?
Oh, yeah,
he was like, you're like, oh, that's amazing. And now you look and you're like, what a load of crap. Like, that's obviously AI.
Yeah, that's horrible. Yeah.
And we're actually, what we've noticed just in the last 6 months is people have become really good at discerning the difference between what is AI and what is not.
Yep.
And so even in that short space of time,
human
beings have adapted.
Learned that, have adapted, yeah.
Yeah. And so we are constantly, constantly generating awarenesses and new neural networks to see these things. So as a salesperson, you know, I'm always asking questions like, okay, so how else could we do this? If we just changed the non-financial parameters, in other words, we didn't just like throw resources at it, like what would we do differently? And maybe it's just a case of training people differently. That could be one. That might be, you know, we're just going to have a different kind of conversation. Or like I did yesterday, one of my peers sent me a sales script and said, look, we're planning on talking to these kinds of ICPs. You know, this is the kind of script we've got. We've really just taken an existing script that works pretty well, and we're going to see if it works here. And I immediately took that to ChatGPT and I said, okay, here's what's different. Macro situation, these are the ICP differences. This is a slight difference in what we're actually selling. The products change. It's the packaging and the pricing change. With that in mind, give me different options of what those conversations would look like.
Mm-hmm.
And ChatGPT like produces like a whole series of new ideas that I wouldn't even thought about. I'm I wouldn't have thought about that. So, and this can, by the way, it doesn't have to happen with AI. You can use, like, I can phone you and say,
yes,
Joe, I've got this idea. We're going to pitch this thing.
Right.
What do you think about this, this, and this?
Right.
And you'd be like, that might work. I'm going to call five people and see if that lands.
Yeah.
Try that on for size.
Yep.
And then you're going to come back to me and say, it worked once, but the rest of the time it didn't work. And so here's my recommendation. We're going to do that. So, again, learning from other people's experiences or mistakes, however you want to look at it. But constantly just asking the question, well, what if we change something? Or what if there was a better way to do this? And get into the habit of constantly reaching out and asking, you know, before I start selling this thing to you, I just want to try selling it to you.
Right.
Like I do that all the time.
Yeah, I know. Totally. Try selling it to someone. 100%.
Yeah. When I was selling for InVision, I call one of our customers and we're like, look, I'm going to pitch you in a couple of weeks. But before I pitch you, I'm going to try this outfit on for size, and you're going to judge it.
Right.
And then you're going to say, look, I think that outfit looks great if you're going to the Met Ball, but you're really doing like a Bear Grylls expedition, so it's not really going to work for you. And then I'd be able to like, okay, great. Can I call you in 2 weeks and bring some? And then by then I've made them, I don't really like the word co-conspiracy, but I've co-authored a story with them. And then I go back and I'm like, hey, I'm going to, everything you told me, I've also asked three other people, 10, 100 people, I don't know, whatever it is. And they've all given me this advice. This is the new thing that I want to show you. And then they're like, oh, that's way better.
Right.
Okay. I'm like, okay, cool. Is this something you'd be willing to pay for?
Exactly.
Yeah, actually it is. Okay, cool.
So good. Because the term I use is they feel like shareholders. like they feel like shareholders in that idea. Like they have, they're invested. They've got skin in it. You know, they didn't get sold anything in the beginning. They were part of an experiment. They understood that they were being asked their advice. They were being treated like an expert. There's a little bit of that, like that skin in the game, that investment. And then sure as hell, like you're right. When you come back to them and you've sharpened your pencils and you've gotten this to a point where it's refined, like they want you to succeed in selling it because they feel like, you know, they're an element in the success of this thing. They're shareholders in this. They have a stake. And I think just to reiterate what you said.
Just on one little nuance there.
Yeah.
It's the fact that you've asked them for their opinion, the fact that they've given you feedback. You may even say, I listened to all the feedback. By the way, I decided not to change it because it had to be a kind of a compromise and blah, blah, blah. And you went,
right.
The fact that they've been heard, that they've
participated
in that, is about all you need. It doesn't have to be like
one-to-one.
I use this metaphor all the time, and it's not great metaphor, but it's kind of like, you know, people can relate to it. Like if I was a young single person and I went out to meet new people, and I went up to somebody and I said, "Hey, I'd love to date you. But I'm not ready to date you because I don't know anything about you. Right. I'm going to come back in 2 hours' time and ask you this question again. Like, hey, will you, you know, can I buy you a drink? And can we like, you know, get to know each other? Just give me like the three things that I need to prepare for in this conversation." Like that would be kind of like that silly metaphor. And that's really what you're doing in these business contexts. You're like, I want to be in business with you, but I don't know if I'm ready to because I don't really know you and you don't really know me. So like, why don't you tell me what I need to know about you?
100%. The most successful relationships I'm aware of that meet this way are fixed up by people they know and trust. And the person fixing you up tells you, oh, you would really love Richard. Like he's a dad. He loves his kids. He's an artist. Like you would love him for these. Like they are doing exactly what you're saying. Usually the person fixing you up is
prepared. But you can do that for yourself. You can advocate for yourself. So I think a lot of us rely on that exported authority, right? So we say, okay, well, only Joe can make introductions for me. And yes, there is like a level of
credibility. Right. My case studies will get me to a point where I can get these introductions or my website, 100%. You're trying to
white paper, all that kind of stuff. But you're like, well, what if I just went there and had that conversation?
Right.
What if I just said,
exactly,
I would like to come back in a couple of days or a couple of weeks with a better pitch. Here's what I've got so far. Tell me how I'm doing.
Yeah.
And that's it. And that's like, breaking the ice, it's kind of silly, it's fun, it's playful.
Yep.
It's got a bit of novelty to it. So
100%.
And if you keep doing that, you'll find out that people will expect it as well. They're like, I'm with a new company, so Richard's gonna probably reach out to me at some point. I'm like, oh yeah, hey, I'm with this new company. We haven't really figured out who we are. We're like, I mean, a good example is Crystal. Crystal has been selling disc-based personality insights to people for years, for like 10 years.
Yep.
And then suddenly we came up with this idea. We're like, hey, the meeting is really the thing that people worry the most about. It's like they're anxious. They have like imposter syndrome about the meeting. Yep. They're kind of anchoring all around. There's like, you know that feeling. You've got that meeting on your calendar and you're like, the entire mood of the day can be like set by just that 30 minutes. You're like,
absolutely.
And you're like, I don't know if I'm prepared. Who's going to say the right thing? Like, 100%. And so we came up with this new product called pre-meeting intelligence. We were like, okay, we're going to go and do that homework for you. Yeah. And then we're going to give you this dossier so that your level of confidence increases so much that you can have this kind of, you know, disarming conversation. You're like, Joe, I just read, you said this.
You posted
that thing. I heard your podcast. You said these things. I want to talk about that. I want to challenge you on those things. Yep. And suddenly like there's this slight but necessary asymmetrical advantage that I know more about you than you think you know about me.
Right. 100%.
And then, you feel like you have an obligation to kind of meet me somewhere. Totally. And then suddenly we're in a good conversation. So like, that's a perfect example of what we're talking about is how do you take this idea of creating an asymmetrical advantage, either through being very, very good at punching above your weight. In other words, having no financial resources, but like figuring it out anyway, being creative, or using the tools that are out there, like Crystal pre-meeting intelligence, to go and like find the information and then come to the meeting and go like,
yep.
hey, I know all this cool stuff about
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
Let's talk about it. And then you're like, oh my God, this is like, you've done your homework. Like, I feel kind of honored that you treated me this way. Like, now the conversation's different than like, so like, this is my worst thing. And I mentioned it before. You sit down in a restaurant and you've been to the same restaurant for 10 years because it's literally your local restaurant. And the wait staff comes up and goes, so have you dined with us before?
Yeah.
Seriously? I'm there every Friday.
That is
every Friday.
You and Gwen, we get along famously. There's nothing that drives my beautiful wife crazier than someone not remembering her when she remembers them. Like it activates every raw nerve she has. If there's like,
but it's not just Gwen, and it's not just me.
Yeah.
All of us
yeah.
want to be seen.
Yeah.
All of us want to be seen. We all want to be heard.
Yeah.
And if we're going to install ourselves in that booth every Friday,
right.
we're making an investment. I'm spending good money and time at your restaurant.
Yeah.
At least show up and meet me somewhere in that in that circuitous relationship. Is that like, sorry, circuitous, cyclical relationship? Like there is a reason I'm here, and there's a reason why you need to recognize that I'm here, and that's the same for every single thing. Going back to Daniel Pink's definition of sales, it's moving somebody from one place to another.
Yeah.
If I now walk into that restaurant and they go, Mr. Banfield, welcome back.
Right.
I'm like,
yeah. Oh yeah. It's
I'm the king.
Yeah, 100%.
And we're just bought new friends. Oh, they know you here. Yeah.
There's a book I'm dying to read. I'm gonna recommend it in advance of reading it at the risk of looking like I don't know what the hell I'm talking about, but I'll put it in the show notes. It's something. It's called like Outrageous Hospitality, or
it's great.
Okay, you've read it.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
And like the guy has an Instagram and a YouTube channel, and so he speaks about all this stuff, and so you can actually hear it from the horse's mouth.
Oh, wonderful!
It's a New York based restaurant.
Yeah.
It's like 81 Congress Street, or I don't know what the name of the restaurant.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't realize there was so much other avenues, because I'm more likely to do those other avenues than read the goddamn book. But I do think that
that's what I told you.
But I do think it does come down to like, it is creating space for those things to happen. And it's creating the opportunity and being thoughtful about making those things happen. Those little micro interactions are incredibly valuable. Like they change the complexion of everything. And part of it is, I guess, like, you know, there's a million meta lessons to take out of this. I do think that one other, and I know we have to wrap up, but a lot of it is about being thoughtful. It's about like being very deliberate and intentional and having like a point of view and having a plan and having like an agenda, or when everything is a script, when everything is like a rigid script, when everything is like, you know, really rammed down your throat and you're just a, you know, a wheel in this machine, like it's not a coincidence.
That's the thing, is that these scripts become devoid of personality.
Yeah.
And then
become gospel.
Compare that to like, okay, somebody calls you, you pick up the phone and they go, you don't know me, but I'd like to talk to you about installing new window panes.
Right.
I know that's the script. I know that's what their boss wants them to say. I know that's how they're getting measured. None of that is useful.
Yeah.
Hey, Joe, it's Richard. I'm kind of nervous to call you because I'm not really good at sales, and this is ultimately going to be a sales call. But I also want to tell you that, like, I think I've got something interesting for you, and if you just give me a minute, we can figure out whether that's useful to you or not. Suddenly, I'm like, oh,
yeah,
this person's being like authentically, you know, they're open, they're sharing the fact that they're nervous, they're helping me understand why they're calling me. They also understand that I know that they know that I know, like, it's, you know, we're in this kind of mess together. Yeah. Like, 100%. I've been asked to make a sales call so I can pay my rent. You don't really want to receive a sales call, but if you give me a couple of seconds, like,
yeah.
And so that's a hardcore, you know, cold call example that's unrelated to what we would be talking about in terms of, you know, relationship-based selling or something like that.
Yeah.
But honestly, it's the same.
It is.
Attitude. 100%. Like, I've always just gone in and we're like, I don't know if this is, you know, going to be good for us, but let's just try. Let's just like have a conversation.
Yep.
And just know your audience. Like,
yeah.
Sometimes people want to get to the point, and there's like no small talk, and that's fine.
Right.
But sometimes do a little small talk if you can. But it's your, you said thoughtfulness. I like the word mindfulness.
Mm.
And when I say mindfulness, I also include the body in that equation, in that like I feel my way into these phone calls. I feel my way into these conversations. I'm like, hey, do you feel it like as like uncomfortable as I do? Because like this is a weird like situation. Or like I might even just say, hey, you know, like I just Carl Smith just made an introduction to somebody today, and like I was like, I might just call a guy like, look, I don't know why Carl introduced us, but I trust Carl and he's a good guy.
Yeah.
So let's give him the benefit of the doubt
right.
and have a slightly awkward conversation for the next 5 minutes and see whether it needs to be 10 minutes or 15 minutes.
Yep. 100%. It's all right. There's a lot more to this topic. I think we should definitely like plan to revisit this in future episodes. I do think though that there's general governing principles that are critically important. And it doesn't really matter if you're in client services sales, if you're in B2C, B2B, whatever the hell. Like if you're, to your point, moving people from point A to point B, if you're moving people from one point to another, a lot of these basic principles are the same thing that served me when I was a waiter.
Yeah. In any role, as a parent, as a spouse, it's like, you know, be upfront. Yeah.
I'm excited if this
introduce novelty. Yeah.
Yeah.
It'll work.
I hope this is my opportunity to write the what my marriage taught me about B2B sales LinkedIn
post. Right, that was fun.
Okay. I love that meme. That is so good. All right. As always, it's a delight to talk to you. Thank you for your time. I'm gonna wrap us up here.